bonds are a painful connection with another person that's based on fear. There's almost an addictive quality that makes them very hard to break. Thank you for joining me today on Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. I'm your host, Dr. Carrie Kern McAvoy, a mental health specialist with over 20 years of counseling experience and a narcissistic abuse survivor. In this episode, we're going to briefly define a trauma bond and then get into the initial steps that you need to take in order to break one. I'm thrilled that you're here with me today. Remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes and leave a review. Let me know what you think of the show. And finally, thank you so much for your donations to this listener-supported podcast because together we're shedding light on all things related to abuse. So let's listen in to this replay of a TikTok Live. I've been hearing a lot from all of you who get a hold of me to let me know how you're doing, what you've been experiencing and going through, the challenges of getting out of a narcissistically abusive relationship, and just how incredibly painful and confusing all of this is. It isn't necessarily triggering. It isn't like I suddenly am back in the thralls of what happened with me, but it does remind me a lot of what I went through. And it's got me thinking about the power of a trauma bond. I know I spent some time a few weeks ago going through the 7 stages of a trauma bond, which I'm happy to review them again today. But I've talked about it before here, but what I'd like to spend time to talk about breaking a trauma bond, because that is one of the most agonizing experiences that most of us have ever gone through. And the more that I looked into the actual making of a trauma bond, the more horrified I was that it's actually an experience of incredible degradation that happens to a human soul, the degree that our sense of self, our confidence, our belief in ourselves, our trust in ourselves is eroded to where we have placed these important qualities that we should have for ourselves, we've placed it in another person. And it is no wonder then when we leave, we feel decimated because we have lost trust in ourselves, we have betrayed ourselves, we no longer are confident. We've depended on this person for the most basic decisions. And now we've suddenly thrust back into the world in a way in which now we have to reclaim all these things we've given away back for ourselves and start over. We essentially have to start over. So what is a trauma bond? It's actually a form of brainwashing. I know that sounds kind of, scary and really intimidating. It happens in various areas of our lives. It's not the first time that you've been swayed by profound hypnotic mind control techniques. It happens whenever you end up buying something you never intended to. But that's not a trauma bond, but that's just falling under the influence of somebody, an outsider. So you've been under the influence of other people before where they've shaped your perspective. They've shaped a decision that you're going to make. They've swayed you. They've influenced you. So it's not exclusive to narcissistic relationships. Military uses it a lot. It's how they take a group of people, come in when they enter in, and they're going to build a squad. And then they, over boot camp, break them down and literally break them down. And so that they begin to depend on each other and they really learn to depend on the sergeants, on those in power, so that they work better as a group. That's the point of it. It's done actually deliberately so that the group functions as one. And so that is actually, in a way, a form of a trauma bond, if you want to say that. It also happens with cults. So you have a very magnetic cult leader who's very sophisticated in the use of persuasion and influence, and particularly profound influence. You can get a group of people to relinquish their control and do things that they probably wouldn't typically do in the confines of this group. HBO has a series on this group that happened that was recent that many people got caught up on. And there's now lately has been some criminal charges leveled against the people who gotten involved. So that happens as well in cults. But what happens in narcissistic abusive relationships is a similar process. In the beginning, you meet somebody who overwhelms you with attention. They give you an abnormal amount that doesn't normally happen on a first meeting between you and the other person. Now, the question is, do they know that they're doing or not know that they're doing? And we can address that later. But let me just leave it that they don't always know what they're doing. Sometimes they just are very good at this. Don Hennessy in his book, How He Gets Into Her Head, says those who do this are as sophisticated at it as pedophiles are sophisticated at grooming and targeting a victim. that there is a set of strategies that are used, whether they have intentionally stumbled into how to use it or not. There's a set of strategies that are being used that causes your susceptibility to go up, your trust to be given too fast, and your boundaries or the degree that you're careful and resistant to drop. You start to feel like you met somebody who's a lot like you. You start to feel a rapid sense of connectedness, a rapport, and you begin to trust them way too fast, and you move into intimacy with them way too fast. But that doesn't just stop there. They then begin to systematically get you to distrust yourself and opt into relying on them for your basic decisions, including decisions you might make around your job or your household or how you handle their relationships. They begin to isolate you from other people and get you to distrust yourself through a series of criticism, which is usually offered not like directly outright, like you look ugly or why are you wearing that today? More of it's prefaced in a way to make you a better person. So you begin to relinquish this thinking that this person is trying to has your best interest. You feel this incredible connection with them. You think you've met your ideal partner, your soulmate, and you have this really high level of trust. So you relinquish your control over these areas based on this criticism because you want to be, who would not want to be the best that you could be? So to be the best that you could be. And in order to also garner their approval in you. It's a very subtle process, but it's very powerful. Then there's manipulation and gaslighting. And the purpose of the gaslighting, again, isn't always obvious. It could be very subtle. I mean, obvious gaslighting would be just outright claiming you're crazy or deflect the Darvo technique that I've talked about before, denying, attacking. It's usually not that overt in the beginning, because if it was, you would say, oh, this is a toxic person. You would move away from them. You would reject them. It's usually more subtle stuff that gets you to challenge your reality and start to replace what you believe and think and do with what they want you to think, believe, and do. So all of that, when all of that happens, it's increasing dependency and it's increasing your lack of reliance on you. You're learning to sort of dismiss what you're thinking and feeling, and you're placing them at the center of the universe, and you're placing their importance of what they think and feel at the top. And this then makes you dependent on them, and that creates this trauma bond, which you think it's love, but you don't realize it actually is based on a need for their approval and connectedness, but also it's based on fear. You don't really realize that it's based on fear. So you get into this relationship, and usually they hold this positive frame, so it's really wonderful, until there's a form of a commitment. So whether you've moved in together, you've bought something together, or you're pregnant, something happens, or you're working with them, or you've started a venture with them, they usually wait for some commitment that locks you in, usually legally or profoundly. And then they begin to reveal who they really are in slips. At first it slips, and then it gets longer and longer and longer. And you start to then wonder who you really are in a relationship with, because the person you thought you met, now you sort of start to see glimpses of somebody you totally don't recognize. It literally starts to feel like you're with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or Dr. Jekyll and Ms. Hyde, that you're having this experience of this duality where you begin to wonder who you're actually in a relationship with, that you feel very, very confused. That by then, though, the trauma bond has pretty much been pretty cemented. You are very invested in this relationship to the extreme point that most people on the outside who sees the conflicting pieces of information you're getting in, sees maybe the betrayals or whatever is happening to you as reasons to get out, but you can't explain why you can't leave. So you look now like the crazy one. I actually lost relationships from those around me who were seeing what was happening and was totally confused, didn't understand why I was staying and why I continued to persist. And I'm sorry it's triggering. Someone just said that's very triggering. I was setting up to talk about what is a trauma bond so we can talk about how to break it. So for those of you who've never been in one, that gives you a sense of what it is and what it's like. So what happens in a relationship is that there's an idealization phase, then you move into a devaluation phase, which is now you're in it and you know something's going wrong. And then you move into, they get ready to discard. The discard happens a lot of levels. It could happen that you decide you just walk out or you decide, or they decide that you're done, or something happens that kind of opens a door and you walk through it and you take advantage of it and you get out. But there's some way you end up getting discarded and now you're on the other side, you're out of the relationship, but you're still trauma bonded. That connection you have hasn't gone away. You still feel it, but now this person's not in your life and now you experience a whole nother level of toxicity that's happening. And part of it is, how do you reclaim yourself? How do you begin to take control of your life, heal, move on, and grow confidence again in yourself? So that's where I want to focus now, because I want to set all that up, but I really want to focus at how do we heal after a trauma bond. I'll tell you, you know, when you're a psychologist and you hear lots of stories and people describe all sorts of things, you think you have a good understanding of what life can be like. I'll tell you, I was unprepared. I was totally unprepared for what it would feel like to have it happen to me. And when I was in the throes of it, I actually realized that I had other trauma bonds that I had no idea with. I had one with my family, my parents. I really had one strongly with my mom. I didn't really realize that I'd spent most of my life trauma bonded, which kind of made me probably susceptible to this trauma bond. But here I am realizing that my relationship and connections has been based on fear. To the point, here's an example. I used to run every major decision I made past my mother or past my late husband or past my new husband. I didn't make decisions independently. Like if I was going to spend a lot of money, I'd want their okay, their permission. I want somebody to sort of approve it. I realized here I'm a, you know, mid-50-year-old woman who's run a business, mind you, more than one business successfully, makes lots of business decisions just fine. And I'm asking the most basic questions of somebody else. That's what a trauma bond looks like. It is an unexplainable, mysterious thing that makes no sense to the outside, because you know you're a grown-ass adult and yet you've learned to depend on other people. You've learned that they require you in order to be in good standing with them. You've learned to depend on their advice and their approval in order for you to move through life. One of the first books I read as I was leaving in the narcissistic relationship was Why Does He Do That? By Lundy Bancroft. Mr. Bancroft spent most of his life's work trying to understand the angry and controlling male mind. Reading through his profile descriptions of abusive men validated what I had just experienced. It confirmed that I had gone through something terrible and helped me understand that it wasn't my fault and that I hadn't done anything to deserve the abuse. It is my great pleasure to announce that I'll be interviewing Lundy Bancroft live February 9th. Learn who abuses and why. What is the effect of abuse on our children? And how do we know when it's time to leave? Come be my guest for this 90-minute webinar and learn firsthand more about abusive men and their relationships. For the final 30 minutes, you get to anonymously ask Mr. Bancroft your questions. Early bird tickets are now on sale. The price is going to go up after the new year. This is a must-see event, and all ticket holders will leave a complimentary replay of the event. So how do you begin to rebuild when you're still connected to another person? So part of the first step is, which is why I spent time talking about a trauma bond, is to realize that you have a trauma bond, to realize that you are starting at a spot where you have actually almost a physiological and addiction to another person, because they've been using your body chemistry against you through the adrenaline and dopamine, and you've been in this setup of moving between excitement and fear, excitement and fear, excitement and fear. So you've gotten into this whole cycle of dependency where you have these really great moments and then things go really bad and you work really hard to get it back to a really great moment and things go really bad, which is that, so you move from adrenaline, the fear, to a dopamine when it's fantastic, back to adrenaline, the fear, back to dopamine when it's fantastic. You never move to the committed phase of the relationship, which excretes different chemicals, excretes actually more vasopressin and oxytocin. Not that you don't get any oxytocin in this first stage, you do, but the relationship doesn't move into a calm, committed phase where it stays, where most of us are supposed to live ongoing. That's what a relationship's supposed to be like. So the first step to breaking a trauma bond is know that you're in one. Know that you're in one. That helps a whole lot because it creates a frame for you to understand why you're experiencing what you're experiencing, and it puts words to it so you don't feel so crazy and wonder what's wrong with you. I think the second thing that's really, really pivotal is to begin to give yourself lots of patience and space. If you had open heart surgery, you would enter into a situation of support. You would have PT. Well, first there would be recuperation and then making sure there's no infection. You would be checking your wounds, making sure it's healing well. And then as you begin to get more strength, they would start you on PT. And then you would slowly, they would give you increasing permissions of what you could do to recover as you re-enter back into life. We need to approach, and this is true for all mental health conditions. I've seen this problem over all the years I've ever treated people. I don't know why we do this so carefully with physical issues and we don't have the same care or concern about psychological issues. To me, that they're the same. If we're as careful with somebody's re-entry after a major surgery, we should be as careful with people re-entry after trauma. You've been highly traumatized. You are emotionally decimated. You are psychologically weak. You need support and you need time to be able to recover after these experiences. And we should create that kind of space and time for each other. But you can create it for yourself by saying to yourself, I'm healing. If I had just had surgery, there would be a process. I need to view this the same and give myself the same leeway to step back into life and not expect myself to go do really super hard things. So what does that mean? It means maybe you really reduce the amount of things that you're doing right now, that you reassess, are you doing too much? Maybe it really means you up and increase your self-care. It also then means you need to reassess how much support you're getting and if it's enough and how to add more. So all these things help give you the space to really recover and recover well. One of the first things I did was I found a support group for survivors, and it was specific because one of the things my ex did was he was extremely sexually promiscuous. He was a serial cheater. He claimed he had a sexual addiction. So what I did is I found a group that specialized in that. And then I, with other 10 other women, we met 3 hours every week. I did that for a year. I met 3 hours every week, led by a coach who is certified in this area of training, and sat with them and healed, cried, processed, were scared together, talked about challenges, was mad together. We processed the trauma that we experienced together. And I'll tell you, that experience of knowing that I could safely say whatever I wanted to a group who understand with no judgment, because how much do we experience in the general world who really don't get what we're doing, really doesn't understand what we went through, and really doesn't have the patience to help us support where we're at, to help us heal. But this group really offered that to me. It was amazing. It was so, so healing. And the other thing, it was a trauma-informed coach, which meant there was no pushing or no asking us to divulge information that we weren't ready to, you know, because a lot of times you're like asked really personal or intrusive questions that are triggering. Maybe you don't even know what you think or feel, and you certainly don't want this person to know these details because it's so personal, such a part of you. This group created the space for me to be able to unpack and unlock what I needed. It also means you may need to think about getting support like a form of coaching or therapy, EMDR. Think about kinds of forms of treatment that might be super helpful for you to have a safe place to even understand what happened. Because here's another very important part of your recovery. You need to also know what it was that made you vulnerable to that person in the first place. Now, this is a super touchy topic, and anybody who follows me knows that I have very strong opinions about this. If you tell me that I'm codependent or that you're codependent, unless you have proof that you come from a home with addictions or you've been in an addiction relationship, I'm going to tell you hogwash. I'm sorry, hogwash. Maybe it's comfortable for some of you to think of yourself that way, but it's a term that psychologically has no full, firm meaning. You can't point to research and tell me what it means. It's based out of an addiction model and fits perfectly when you look at what happens to relationships with those who are supporting an addiction. We start to try to help save the person who's using from using. And when we do that, we get sick with them. That's what codependency technically is about. It's about addictions. It was never meant to apply to anybody who gets into a toxic relationship. I think, and I'm going to give you a little bit of my opinion, I think it's been a way for us to attack the most vulnerable people in society by pointing to their behaviors and causing them to be responsible for what predators have done to us. What we need to be doing is shift the focus, shift the spotlight, put it back onto those who are abusers and offenders, and call them out for the bad behavior. You were brainwashed and manipulated and influenced. And if you were in got caught in a cult, we wouldn't be saying to you what a stupid idiot you were. We would say how super scary that cult leader was. We don't talk about Jim Jones's or Koresh's followers as being idiots. We say how evil these people were that duped those people into doing the things that they did. Why are we not as supportive of victims of narcissistic and all sorts of domestic violence and abuse? We should have the same compassion we show for those who are coming out of those situations. We should show that to each other. And we don't. Instead, we label, we criticize, we put down, we insult victims instead of holding predators and offenders responsible. I see how many of you have been profoundly impacted by the power of what's happened to your life, that it's devastated you, made you scared to do things, keeps you home, keeps you locked in your life because you don't want it to happen again. Something's wrong with that. We need to change the way as a culture we understand domestic violence so that this is a completely different situation and that this doesn't happen like this. So you're not codependent. Here's the interesting thing. Toxic people, particularly more kind of predatory people, put you in these positions. They know you will opt into the nice direction. They know they'll control you by putting you into in a spot where you don't want to be mean or challenging them. They deliberately will, they'll just set you up in a way that just makes you super uncomfortable. So you'll, by default, err into the direction of moving along and being easygoing. And they do that on purpose. So part of the things I'm having to learn to do is when somebody does this, to say to myself, very toxic person, this is a setup, this person is doing this deliberately, second of all, and it's now you have permission because they put you in this bind for you to do what you need to do to protect yourself in the bind, including even if it means shaming them or calling them out or acting angry, that it's now permissible to be an unkind person in this moment because what they've done to you is unkindness. And you need to protect yourself. For example, if you like on dating apps, you'll get people ask you like, one of the weird ones that guys will ask, I don't know if women ask this, but guys will ask this, do I look like what you expected? Now, you already know by the way that they ask the question, the answer is no. That's why they're asking you. The answer is no. But if you say no, you look really mean. And now you're like in an uncomfortable position. So it's those kinds of setups that they'll do. But you had what was reasons why you were vulnerable. And it's not because you're codependent. It may have been because you've learned niceness instead of kindness. And I'm going to do a video on that because there is a big difference between being nice and being kind. You may blindly trust people instead of having a conditional trust where you start from a trusting position instead of looking to whether or not this person should have your trust. The other thing that you may be doing is that you really believe the world basically is good. And if you were good to the world, it'll be good to you. Unfortunately, that is not also true. But there is sort of the basic hardwiring about how you view the world that makes you vulnerable to toxic people who then see that as like an advantage. And then they take that advantage. And yes, it is healthy boundaries, but it's more than that. It's part of having to see, this is the part that why simply learning better boundaries don't work. Boundaries require you to feel entitled to hold them. See, even that you want to think, oh, well, then you just again need to learn how to hold boundaries. No, there's some of us are what's called low in harm avoidant. Sandra Brown says that all of us have a level of which we're harm avoidant. Some of us approach the world in a more paranoid position. We're more suspicious and guarded. We're more vigilant on purpose. We're hardwired to be that. Those of us who are not kind of see that as a negative quality. I don't really want to be accused of being paranoid or hypervigilant or guarded. I don't see that as really great qualities. But when you meet people like this, those who have higher harm avoidant techniques and style are better protected than those of us who don't. So if you're more believe in the goodness of others, you believe the world's basically a good place, you really want all of us to get along, you really believe that that's possible, you have what's called low harm avoidant, which is a beautiful thing. It makes you easy to get to know. You're not guarded, but it's now a vulnerability that you have with certain people. So let's put this together. You have boundaries. Let's pretend both groups, the low harm avoidant and the high harm avoidant groups, have good boundaries. The low harm avoidant group isn't going to see some interactions as boundary violations when they might be. Maybe they're not, but maybe they might be. And those who have high harm avoidant tendencies would, because they tend to be more suspicious. So it isn't a boundary problem. It's the way in which you approach the world problem. It's your frame. The way you see the world is the problem. So just teaching better boundaries in itself isn't going to correct this problem. Again, that's why I think when we come back out and we say to people, just get better at boundaries or just get better at trusting your intuitions. But if you don't know your natural bent to how you see the world, and then these techniques won't be any good. It won't work. It'd be like saying, I'm trying to think of an example. You're approaching it at a practical level, and it's more of a hard wiring problem. You can tell a computer system to see a program with more depth and more pixels, but if the graphics card isn't capable of doing that, then you're not going to change those things. Those things aren't going to be better. And it's not the fault of the boundary setting. It's the hard wiring is the problem. So we need to go back to understanding our natural bent so that we are less vulnerable in those places. So how is your healing going? Have you successfully broken a trauma bond? We often feel in a confusion about the abusive person that keeps us stuck. That's why my course and workbook called First Steps to Leaving a Narcissist is so helpful. It helps you tear apart the false belief and the deceptions. It is the first step to taking back control of your life and regaining your power while you reclaim your voice. If you'd like to learn more, see the link in the show notes. And I'll see you back on Thursday. Bye-bye.